Welcome to the second episode of Talk Poverty Radio, now on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm your other co-host, Tracy Ross.
We are very excited to have with us a very special guest in studio, Rebecca Len from Media Matters for America. Welcome, Rebecca.
Greetings. Thank you. Excited to be here.
And we may have to use last names. We have too many Rebeccas.
Oh, yeah, too many Rebeccas.
So
yes.
From here on, you are Len. I am Vallis.
Len. Miss Len.
And I'm still Tracy. But it's not as exciting. But to start, can you just briefly tell us what Media Matters does and what your role with the organization is?
Sure, absolutely. So Media Matters is a progressive media watchdog group, plain and simple, that's based here in Washington, D.C. We are a team of 75 nerds, brave women and men who monitor American news media around the clock.
Brave nerds.
Brave nerds. Super nerds. We start our monitoring at 5 a.m. every single morning, working in shifts all the way through until about 1 a.m. the next morning, and literally fact-checking misinformation in real time. Fox News runs a problematic segment about SNAP benefits. We hit back immediately, producing a blog post fact-checking the claim and pushing that out to press and organizing and rallying allies around it to get Fox News to correct themselves. So sometimes that can be kind of rare, but it's also about inoculating mainstream media against that misinformation. So we encounter a lot of misinformation about poverty in the economy. And as you well know, there's a lot of it, especially in the media conversation.
Absolutely.
So you guys are kept busy. This is full employment for brave nerds.
Full employment for brave nerds, indeed.
And we're excited that you're here today because you're going to be one of the friends of the show that pops in from time to time. And we wanted to welcome you early on so that we could get a relationship with our listeners and they can get familiar with your work and all the great things that you guys are doing.
We feel very welcome. Thank you.
So what we were really looking forward to having you on to talk to us about today is kind of what's going on in the media that needs fact-checking. What's going on that's wrong when it comes to how the media is talking about poverty?
Well, there's a lot of it. And I would say Baltimore was a huge window into how the media talks about poverty, especially in urban America. On Fox News, now Fox News spews the usual problematic stuff, right? But this was particularly nefarious.
Yeah, I was going to say, you were diving right in with Fox News.
They kept us busy. Let's just put it out there. They definitely kept us busy. So as soon as protests emerge in Baltimore, Fox News was around the clock asking the question, who's to blame for the protest? Who's to blame for the unrest?
Because it's as simple as that. It's a very simple question.
So the network seemed to have the non-negotiable answer. And that was threefold. It's Baltimore families, it's lack of good character, and it's quote unquote entitlements. Sound familiar?
Entitlements were the reason that, you know what? I can't wait to hear more. I'm not even going to jump in. I just want to, let's hear. Let's hear it. Bring it out.
And in addition to that, it was portraying the protesters as thugs and as violent.
Which
constantly.
Thugs is obviously a dog whistle term that people are increasingly using because it's, I guess the FCC will allow you to say that instead of some other words.
Indeed. So never mind the death of Freddie Gray. Never mind decades of legitimately brewing anger over police brutality in Baltimore and growing rifts of trust between the community in Baltimore and law enforcement and nationwide. Fox personality after Fox personality have claimed that parental neglect, verbatim, parental neglect, family breakdown, and single-parent families are truly to blame. And apparently it's lack of good character, too. The network's resident doctor, Keith Ablo, suggested that if it wasn't for self-hatred engendered by single mothers in their kids, we wouldn't have such unrest. And Bill O'Reilly was ongoing about how this is a problem of personal responsibility, of personal behavior.
So I make it a business to not watch Fox News all that much. Did they cite any data, or is this just their hunches?
Not really. This is hunches.
Okay.
Right?
It's an optimistic question, Tracy. Yeah. Did they cite
I was interested in, you know, what these social scientists that they were, you know, digging up that might provide them with a line or two.
See, if they cited data, that would completely undercut their point.
Right? Exactly.
Because then they would be restricted to facts.
Right.
Yeah, gee whiz.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. Gee whiz. So this is the Fox News bubble at work. And then, of course, the last facet of this was right on cue, anti-poverty programs take the hit. Now, these programs that they call entitlements, belovingly called entitlements, that create a culture of dependence. Charles Payne said that the unrest can be traced back to the failed war on poverty. And get this, a minimum wage increase. And others.
Wait. A minimum wage increase is to blame for the unrest. And why don't we have sound effects for the show, Tracy? Can we get
on
that?
Yeah, we need womp, womp.
I don't know why I flapped my arms. This is radio.
And this talking point, which we've heard many, many times before, I mean, it was a huge hit among conservatives on the Sunday shows as well, that 50 years of anti-poverty programs hasn't worked and it's only created a trap. Representative Paul Ryan said that verbatim on CBS's Face the Nation. So that's the conservative echo chamber at work. Now, we can talk about the facts all day, right? The official poverty rate is lower than it was before the war on poverty and far lower than predicted poverty rates if programs were removed, right?
Well, and that's so I want to jump in there. Yeah. If we're going to get into the fact section,
yeah.
are we into the facts?
We definitely need to. Okay. We've just put out a lot of myths. We got to put out some facts.
We'll do some facts. So I actually should say before we even get into the facts, I know we've talked a lot now about Fox and the conservative echo chamber. Of course, that set of myths wasn't really even just restricted to that conservative echo chamber. We saw op-eds on the and columns on the pages of the New York Times by David Brooks, among others, right, making the same allegations.
Absolutely.
Although, again, he might have peppered some facts in there, but they might have only appeared to be facts because when you dig beneath the surface, they aren't true.
Right.
You know, truthy facts anyway.
Right.
But, you know, just to get into what you just said, right, about the poverty rate and what's happened to it since the war on poverty, there's this myth out there that we fought a war on poverty and poverty won. That's the way that it often gets talked about, right? But the reality is that if you actually look at the poverty rate when you take into account all of those vital anti-poverty programs like food stamps and other kinds of nutrition assistance, like the EITC, for instance. When you actually look at the rate, including those types of assistance, you will see that our poverty rate today would be twice as high if not for those programs.
Right.
So game, set, match, from as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And when you also break it down by program and you look at SNAP, for instance, every dollar increase in SNAP benefits generates about $1.70 in economic activity. Obviously, cutting these programs is not the solution. And I mean, there's more to be done, but cutting these programs is not the solution. And one last thing I'll say about the conservative echo chamber, we do need to really name the motives behind these attacks from Fox News and others. And maybe we can bring Brooks into this as well.
I think we should. Yeah, I think I just did.
But there's something pretty damn nefarious at play here. I mean, the misguided faulting of families for this, the talk about a lack of good character and programs and the attacks on the programs that help those struggling the most is an all too familiar tune from these guys. But what needs to be named is that this is more than just well-paid cultural warrior pundits waxing poetic on the airwaves to drive ratings and get their paychecks at the end of the day. This is a long-term sustained campaign to use the tragedy of death and anger over police brutality to justify cuts to important programs and attack poor people, and ultimately to undermine an economy that where everyone has a fair shot, right? And I think we really have to name that. Fox News and others demonized families and the most vulnerable as Ferguson and New York City rallied for justice for Mike Brown and others to attack the safety net. Fox has long been on a desperate search to find the next poster child of anti-poverty program, quote, abuse or problems with anti-poverty programs in general. A prime example of that was when they tracked down California surfer Jason Greenslate, who purportedly prides himself on, you know, not working on food stamps and using his food stamps to buy lobster and shellfish, right, and enjoying the good life. And there's a direct pipeline between Fox News echo chamber to the Hill. I mean, Jason Greenslate became the poster child for politicians and congressmen and women using that story to cut and justify cuts to SNAP. So there is that very problematic campaign at play. This is very coordinated. It probably goes without saying.
And to kind of echo some of the sentiments that Rebecca was expressing, that it's obviously not just conservatives or, you know, even the far, far right of the conservatives out there, but we've seen progressives echoing some of the myths out there, particularly when it comes to single-parent households, that if we just had more fathers involved and these sorts of things that speak to, you know, our, I guess, values as a culture that aren't necessarily based in all the facts. And there was a study released this week by Harvard economist Raj Chetty and others that focused on the Moving to Opportunity program of the 1990s. And they have now robust levels of data and have been able to show that, you know, a significant amount of these families were headed by single mothers. And because of the support of these programs, their children had about a 31% increase in their lifetime earnings. They were more likely to go to college and they were more likely to get married. So it wasn't even a matter of a program promoting marriages. It was a program promoting families living in high opportunity neighborhoods. And I think that was left out of the Baltimore conversation. It just was, you know, where are the fathers and these single mothers are to blame, essentially.
Well, and all too often, right, we hear this trope kind of trotted out, which is that marriage is the difference between poverty and not poverty. That's sort of set up the the goalposts for this whole conversation. But the reality is, if you actually look at the facts, which I'm so glad we have the chance to do with you here now, you actually find that there are more married parents in the United States than there are never married parents, right? So I don't even know how people can continue to trot that out when we've sort of so thoroughly killed that myth with the facts. So I think, Tracy, this brings us to our number of the week.
That is right. So each week we throw out a number that highlights a policy debate or issue to help us explore this a little bit deeper. And this week's number of the week is 9.3 million.
9.3 million. That's a really big number, Tracy.
That
I wonder,
is a very big number.
I wonder what it could represent.
Any guesses? Any guesses, Lynn or Valis? I mean, it's a big one.
Does it have to do with mothers?
It does have to do with mothers. We also did frame this as our kind of our Mother's Day episode,
right.
So that was a great guess.
Perfect.
Happy
Rebecca,
Mother's do you want to explain what that is?
So 9.3 million is the number of people in married parent families living in poverty in the United States. Mm. So if marriage were somehow the magical antidote to poverty, wouldn't that be a lot closer to zero?
I think so.
I think so, too.
I know. We're like, yes. Correct.
Yeah, there is nodding happening in the studio. Thank you. All right.
I keep forgetting nodding doesn't have a soundtrack.
Right.
So it's so frustrating when we hear these media themes that, I mean, especially when you combine this with somehow the raise in the minimum wage has caused the unrest that we've seen in Baltimore. I mean, we actually there was a lot of attention given to raising the minimum wage in the last couple of weeks because Patty Murray actually introduced a bill to raise the minimum wage to $12 by 2020. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And CAP did some number crunching and found that if we raise the minimum wage to $12, we will save $5.3 billion in food stamps every single year. So if these Fox commentators are really concerned about trying to reduce our spending on public assistance, maybe we should be raising the minimum wage.
Maybe we should be raising the minimum wage. Amen. Amen, Valis. And I think something in a huge, there's a huge deficit of personal stories in the media conversation. And if only Fox News talked to mothers living in poverty to ask them what their take is on the problems at hand. I think that would be important, and mainstream media as well. I mean, it's across the board, and it's not, numbers are very, very important in illustrating the challenges that we face, but personal stories are just as important as well.
And personal stories that actually reflect the lived experiences
exactly
of people
right.
in poverty, as opposed to the food stamp surfer who reflects no one else in the United States
except
receiving
for
nutrition
him.
Assistance
exactly.
but him.
Right. Let's talk about effective debunking there.
Right. Right.
Indeed.
Well, Len, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We can't wait to have you back.
Thank you very much.
And where can people find more information about what Media Matters does?
You can go to our website at mediamatters.org, and or you can follow us on Twitter at MMFA. Please do.
Hashtag Follow Friday.
Hashtag Follow Friday.
So for today's episode, we are extremely excited to have a very special guest with us, Sam Seder, host of The Majority Report and many, many other radio shows. Sam, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
So to start out, I've just been noticing on your Twitter page, you've been talking a lot about 2016. Do you think that more candidates will be talking about poverty during their campaigns?
I can tell you that when Bernie Sanders made his announcement, it was, I think, the first time I really heard poverty in at least anyone's first announcement. And I think my hope is he will force some to talk about it. I mean, let's be frank. You know, when those on the right talk about poverty, it is really coming from a different place. I mean, there is more so than I think we've even seen over the past 20 or 30 years. The right has sort of returned to this notion that if you are living in poverty, it is indicative of a moral failing on your part. And it has given them a license in their mind to shame the poor, to humiliate the poor, to because, you know, and the flip side of that, of course, is that if you're wealthy, then you have some type of moral superiority. I mean, that's why you're wealthy. It's indicative of that. To the extent that we're going to hear it come out of the mouths of candidates on the right, I don't know that it's going to be anything that is going to be terribly helpful. You know, I hope that Bernie Sanders, you know, will help focus on that. But, you know, and to her credit, Hillary Clinton came out and spoke about at least prison reform and the relationship between police and certain communities. And frankly, you know, that's a big part of this story, too. I don't think that the only part of the story coming out of Baltimore is about race. I think it's about class. To a large extent, we have very underserved communities in this country where they have no job, they have no hope, and then we basically say to the police, make sure that these people stay here and are quiet. To a certain extent, the police are a manifestation of the way that society has decided just to warehouse these people.
And in fact, something that we heard a lot of last week on Talk Poverty Radio was that mass incarceration and the criminal records that can haunt people for decades thereafter are major drivers of poverty and inequality in America. But turning back to the conversation in the run-up to 2016, we've been hearing a lot on both sides of the aisle about newfound interest in poverty and inequality, yet there are those who are still opposed to raising the minimum wage, for instance, or even having a federal minimum wage. How do we square the rhetoric with that kind of reality?
Well, we can't. Like you say, you reverse engineer what their policies are to address this. And in fact, it shows that there is no interest in poverty. I mean, they know the polling. I mean, I think there is a broader understanding that there is something systemically wrong, that it's not just a question of I've made bad choices, or I shouldn't have left the job when I left the job, or I shouldn't have bought that house. And I think that awareness is what gets the right to the position where they talk about it. You know, once you dig past the rhetoric, you start to see, and you reverse engineer what these policies, sort of their outcomes they bring, you start to see that this is really about, you know, poor shaming. So when Paul Ryan gets up there and talks about people, tells a fictional story that he's gotten wrong, about a kid who would rather have a brown bag lunch, you know, as opposed to getting free lunch from school. I mean, that's just, it's silly. It's nonsense. Kids want to be able to eat. And so you're faced with that reality. What are you going to do? You're either going to provide nutrition for kids or you're not. They're not going to eat their sense of moral integrity. That's just nonsense.
What was Paul Ryan's line with that? He said that the kid with the free lunch had a void in his soul, right, or something, right? Because he didn't have the brown paper bag. It was astounding.
Well, I mean, and the irony was, it was a story that was told to him by somebody by a Wisconsin official, I believe it was.
Eloise Anderson, yes, former welfare secretary in Wisconsin.
He bastardized the story in the first place. Ultimately, the story itself turned out to be a fiction to begin with. But the idea was that given the choice, would this guy want a brown bag lunch or would he want a free one from school? And he said, well, a brown bag lunch would mean that my parents cared enough to send it, you know, send me to school with a lunch. You know, that right there gets to this notion of if a kid does not have enough, that's somehow a moral failing. I have very little doubt that the vast majority of those kids who are not sent to school with a brown bag, their parents do care. The implication by Paul Ryan's story is that they don't care and that this is a moral failing. But even if you believe that, even if you believe that the parents didn't care, are you still going to punish the children by basically saying, you need your dignity, so you're not going to get a lunch? I mean, this world that the right likes to live in, where they sort of pretend that this is about a moral failing and that if somehow we were able to impose a certain morality on people, this would all go away. But, you know, we know that even if their diagnosis was correct, that their prescription is fundamentally impossible. And they would then complain about the nanny state, right?
So given the fact that conservatives are blatantly making things up, do you have any advice for how we can more effectively lift up the facts? And how do we translate these ideas into action?
I mean, bringing people in, having people tell their story. I think for most people, money is at some point an issue. It may not be a question of whether or not they're going to be able to have three meals a day. And I think, you know, it's just a question of making these dynamics relatable and making people just sort of aware that, you know, to the extent that they feel these dynamics and can have a lot greater stakes. It's not hard to make people sort of more aware of that. And I just think that fundamentally, most people, look, I think that there are certain people you're never going to reach. And there's not a lot of value in spending a lot of time trying to reach those people. But I think the vast majority of Americans, if they are made more conscious of these issues, will respond. Because I think, you know, most Americans respond with empathy as opposed to sort of closing down.
Sam Seder, thank you so much for joining us on Talk Poverty Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. We'll have to have you back soon.
Pleasure to have you on.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Tracy Ross. We've been covering a lot of the events going on in Baltimore. And we now know that recently, state's attorney Marilyn Mosby announced that she would file charges against the six officers involved in the arrest that led to Freddie Gray's death. To get a better look at what's going on in the community where Freddie Gray lived, we spoke to Janae Desmond Harris, staff writer for Vox.com, who covers race, law, and politics, who spent a few days in Baltimore last week. Hi, Janae.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, Janae, you are currently in Baltimore, right?
Yes, I am. I've been here since Monday.
So before, you know, I jump into some of the questions I have about what's going on, can you, the people who have not been looking at the news lately, give kind of a brief rundown of what's been going on?
Well, yeah, most people who are listening to this, I'm sure, have probably heard. In the wake of the death of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man in Baltimore, whose spine was severed while he was in police custody and later died, there have been protests, both peaceful and not so peaceful, in Baltimore, a lot of them involving young people, and they pretty much uniformly have been called riots now at this point because there's been so much looting and property damage to the city. Monday night was pretty bad, and they've sort of tapered off a bit since then. And there's still definitely tensions in the city, and the expectation that there will be more protests and demonstrations once we find out whether the six officers who arrested Freddie Gray are arrested or indicted or not.
And so you've been there this week, and you recently wrote an article after talking to several people in the community where Freddie Gray lived. The title of that piece is In West Baltimore, Some Residents See Rioting as a Rational Response to Daily Despair, which is on Vox.com right now. Can you tell us about what you've been hearing from people and what their take on the situation is?
Yeah, so what I did was I went to Freddie Gray's neighborhood in West Baltimore just to hear how people who weren't necessarily out in the streets protesting or weren't necessarily speaking, having an opportunity to speak to national media as representatives of community organizations or churches, we're thinking. So just kind of regular people who live in his neighborhood and experienced a lot of the same things that he did as far as their interactions with police. What I found out was that there was a lot more nuance than I'd heard before when it came to how people viewed the protests that became violent. It's not so much that there are these violent, you know, horrible, crazy, destructive people who are the bad guys, and then there are the good people who just want peace and want to work things out amicably. There, from my experience, are groups of people in the middle who did not participate in the looting or the riots, but really understand the desperation that led there and are somewhat ambivalent when it comes to whether or not they think it was a good idea. A lot of them have really extensive negative interactions with police officers, no sense at all of justice, and a really deep sense of despair and hopelessness. And they understand where those kids who rioted were coming from. So I thought that was an important point, because too often I think it makes a neat story for the media to tell that there are the bad guys and the good guys. But in fact, there are just, you know, some people who live in Baltimore who are in the middle of this and understand that it took this to bring national attention to where they live and feel kind of conflicted about it themselves.
And you mentioned that this is a common experience for a lot of the residents of the community that Freddie Gray grew up in. And in your piece, you wrote, the consensus that this experience is so commonplace that being antagonized by the police without any remedy is simply part of life for Black people in certain parts of Baltimore is jarring. And you said that people just kind of in passing kind of casually mentioned, oh, yeah, you know, cops will slap you. They'll take your phone battery.
Mm-hmm.
So what can be done to repair community police relations?
Right. It's hard to say. And of course, I think the fact that there is no easy answer is the reason why we see such deep frustration. Like you said, I talked to young guys, you know, around Freddie Gray's age, 25, 26, 27, 28 years old, who just said, yeah, of course, you know, a police officer has come up and hit me. They've taken my phone. They've dropped me off on the other side of town knowing that I'm going to get beat up there. I know people who have been hurt. I know people who have been killed. It's just so commonplace. It's really jarring as an outsider to hear that there are so many of these stories, not all of which make the news. And when it comes to solutions, I don't know what they are, but one thing I can say is that the people I spoke to had very little faith in the people who are holding themselves up as the leaders of the community, the religious leaders, the community organizers, the mayor, you know, who is African-American. They don't see themselves as on the same page as these people at all. They think those people are sort of, you know, working for their own interests, worried about their jobs and their money, and, you know, not truly interested in even coming and speaking to people like them.
And you mentioned the mayor is African-American, and a lot of people have been saying, you know, this is a different situation than Ferguson because there's a Black mayor, the city council president's Black, the police chief, the top prosecutor, half the police force. And they're using this as evidence that this situation is about class. It's not about race then. So how would you respond to that?
Well, I think it definitely complicates the situation. I can understand why people would say that. In Ferguson, it was easy to point to the fact that there were very few Black elected officials, and here there are. So it really makes you have to define what's going on a little more specifically. I think it's very clear that there's more than class issues happening in Baltimore. One, just about all these people who have the experiences we're talking about with police are Black, and they live in segregated neighborhoods, and that happened intentionally. There's, you know, a whole history to that as far as housing segregation and poverty and economic inequality. Jamelle Bouie had a great piece on Slate for that called The Deep Troubling Roots of Baltimore's Decline. And I think it's a really important read, and it's a really important reminder to look at what's happening as more than just what's in front of us right now, but as the result of an entire history, much of which is like totally racialized and explicitly racist. And that's how we got there. So yes, there are Black elected officials, but that doesn't solve 100 years of racism.
Right. And I think a lot of people kind of assumed that whenever we're talking about discrimination against Black people, it's a Black versus white conversation. Mm-hmm. Whereas obviously, you know, there's studies about doctors, regardless of race, give inferior care to Black patients. It shows that white supremacy really is something that inflicts all people. So it's really all of us need to do better by people of color.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing that, you know, can get sort of confusing when these debates are oversimplified. I just spoke to a scientist recently who measures police bias by giving people tests that involve a video game where you have to decide whether or not to shoot the suspect. And sometimes the suspect has a gun, and sometimes he's just holding a cell phone. People, of course, make a mistake and shoot the black suspects with a cell phone far more often. And he found that black people and black police officers do that just as often as white police officers. So that's pretty disturbing. And like you said, it does sort of reinforce the idea that bias can be institutionalized, and that, yes, black people and other people of color can carry out racist policies and practices and biases and assumptions as well.
And so the other day you shared an article on Twitter called Why Baltimore Rebelled. And it closed by saying police immunity and dehumanizing poverty can only coexist for so long. Do you think we're at a tipping point where the dual problems of racial and economic injustice will just become serious issues for the country's leaders to tackle? I mean, we saw Secretary Clinton give a relatively major speech on mass incarceration. Do you think that this will we're finally at a tipping point where people are going to be talking about these issues in serious ways?
Well, I would too point to the speech that Clinton gave as evidence that this is something that people who are running for office know that they have to talk about. I think whether anything will actually be done about it is a different problem. We're certainly not at a tipping point where this is a new thing, or this is something that's suddenly become problematic. It's simply something that's being talked about more. So I think that there's opportunity for people to make it known that this is an issue that they care about and that they're going to bring with them to the ballot box. But whether or not we see the results of that in like one or two election cycles, I'm not sure. I'm not incredibly hopeful about that.
Sure. And I think a lot of the attention that police violence in the past, 18 months has received is due in large part to the Black Lives Matter movement. It's a rallying cry, but it's also a popular, social media hashtag. But leaders are often, dismissive of youth-led movements, saying that they're leaderless or they don't have specific goals or demands. What do you think about the potential of having, youth-led movements really shepherd in this change?
Well, as far as the Black Lives Matter, and when I'm saying that, you can imagine a hashtag in front of it. I think one thing that's been really powerful and that has allowed young people to have their voices heard on these issues is social media. I wrote a piece for Vox a while back that basically argued that social media was largely responsible for the attention to Ferguson. I think there's a really interesting thing happening right now where people of color and black people in particular are overrepresented on Twitter and on Facebook, and journalists love to get stories from there. So whatever stories young people and young people of color are talking about are going to get picked up. And, you see the hashtag one day and the next day you see it on MSNBC. I think that's a really great symbiotic relationship, and I absolutely think that's part of the reason that Ferguson made national headlines. Now, granted, that also was sort of like a perfectly designed for social media moment with Michael Brown's body being in the street and people talking about it on Twitter before it was talked about in the news, but I do think there are some elements of that that have been replicated in other cases. That said, it's also like a very temporary relationship. Social networks change, what journalists are interested in change. But I do think we're at a moment where young people and youth-led movements have a lot of power to sort of harness that medium to exercise their interest.
And so you mentioned, obviously, journalists more or less mining social media to come up with their stories. And we saw that actually a couple of pictures were misused by the media. There were photos of white protesters that were trying to pull away drunk sports fans from attacking the protesters. But the news stories were written, oh, no, the scary black people are attacking the innocent white sports fans. And the people caught in the images had to speak out and say, actually, no, you're using my picture incorrectly.
Right.
I was on the side of the protesters. So obviously we've seen those kinds of mistakes. But what do you think that the mainstream media has gotten right and wrong in reporting on this issue?
Well, first of all, it's like I think that's tragic. And I also have like empathy for the people who made that mistake, because I think it's so hard to sort of go into a situation and not really have an overarching narrative about it, or have one that's like deep in your subconscious that you don't even realize you're reporting to confirm. And it's really easy to make mistakes and get things wrong. Of course, journalists have a responsibility to do more than just pull from social media and make assumptions. It's our responsibility to confirm and to verify. We haven't been relieved of that job just because we have access to Twitter. I think the mainstream media has done a good job of capturing the intensity of what's happening, of getting as many different voices heard as possible. But at the same time, I think they're limited because the nature of the 24-hour news cycle is that you end up talking about what's happening in that moment. You know, there's violence. Some people say it's good. Some people say it's bad. And there's not really a lot of room for, like, a lot of the larger context that I was talking about in Jamel's article at Slate that helps people understand not just what is happening and who's saying what on this particular Tuesday, but how did we get here and what does this mean in, like, the larger scheme of things.
Absolutely. And so I'm just going to switch gears for a moment. And a couple months ago, you wrote a piece about the 1965 Moynihan Report, which essentially blamed the disproportionate levels of black poverty on a quote-unquote ghetto culture, a lack of married couples, absent single fathers. And your piece kind of, I guess, lays out the case that a lot of sociologists, thankfully, have moved away from this. But obviously, politicians are still kind of playing into this idea. We heard Paul Ryan discussed, you know, a culture of inner city men last year. Even, you know, President Obama, while he'll say a lot of the right things, I think, in the aftermath of these kinds of incidents, he'll also say and discuss the role of the absent father, even though obviously we know Trayvon Martin had a father, Jordan Davis had a father. How do you think we can discuss the disproportionate impact of poverty on people of color in a more productive way?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that it does seem that it's really politically expedient for politicians from both parties to sort of play the black pathology card. And of course, we see it all the time. Some people, I think, have good intentions when they're saying it. I think doing things like focusing on absent black fathers or families who don't read to their kids and don't care about education and all of these things that you hear people feeling, sometimes they're said very sincerely. And sometimes they're said by people who aren't politicians, like Charles Barkley or Bill Cosby. I think they're theories that are really, really palatable to a lot of people because they're easy to understand. And they create the sense that there are easy solutions and that this isn't as tragic as we thought because, you know, these people could help themselves if they really wanted to. So in some ways, they kind of pacify people who would otherwise be concerned about these issues. I think those of us who don't agree that the problem is black cultural pathology have to do a better job of explaining what is the problem. Of course, that's when we start to talk about things like systemic racism. And I think we need to talk about that well enough and clearly enough that that it becomes a household term and that our explanations are as appealing as like a Bill Cosby speech or a Charles Barkley rant. I think Color Lines did a really good job recently in a series of videos explaining systemic racism and like 30-second chunks narrated by Jay Smooth that were really, really easy to watch, really clear explanations, graphics, numbers. They held your attention. So I think that's a good model for what we need to do moving forward to sort of bridge the gap between people who get it and don't.
Well, we'll make sure to follow your pieces on Vox. Thank you so much for your coverage. And Janae had great coverage of the events in Ferguson as well. So please check out her writing. And we'll have to have you on again soon.
Please do. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm your co-host, Rebecca Vallis. Our next guest is Linda Blum, a professor at Northeastern University and author of the recent book Raising Generation RX, Mothering Kids with Invisible Disabilities in an Age of Inequality. Linda, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, Linda, someone might look at the title of your book and think that it's just a book about kids who are prescribed psychotropic medications. But that's really just the surface level of what's going on in your book. There's really a lot more there. I wonder if you could read just a little from the introduction to give our listeners a taste.
Yes, I'm very happy to. First, this is a book about persistence and change in 21st century U.S. families and gender arrangements. Such arrangements have been changed by the wholesale entry of mothers into the labor force and, as I will come to below, the declining opportunities for men's breadwinning. Yet this is, nonetheless, a book about how we persist in assigning mothers primary responsibility for children and the major share of blame when things go wrong. Second, this is also a book about the new economy and the post-industrial workers it now requires, with a sharp divide between its winners and losers. And third, this book is about the neoliberal ideology or belief system which undergirds this high-stakes new economy, a belief system valuing individual over public responsibility or government protection, beliefs that have created a more challenging context for family life and child-rearing in the United States today.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So I think that gives us a sense of maybe some of the major themes that you explore in this book. And I wanted in particular, as this is our Mother's Day episode, to drill down especially into the theme of mother blame. And so your book in particular, you spent significant time with 48 mothers at a range of incomes, of various races, and you observe that mothers' options for managing a so-called high-need child, the families you're looking at are mothers with kids with disabilities, it very much is driven by certain factors, their class resources, whether they're single or married, and the gender and race, in fact, of their children. Can you give us an example or two of how those kinds of factors come into play?
You know, I would say that all of the mothers experienced a good amount of stigma in their communities for having, you know, unruly, struggling kids. And for these mothers, they felt, for example, that their mothering was more harshly judged, that they were considered more suspect by school officials, by healthcare providers, social service providers. So, for example, I met mothers, single mothers, who were actually questioned by Child Protective Services because of kids' disruptions in school and unruly behavior in school. One, for example, who was married at the time, who had advanced degrees and a very impressive career, the social workers actually were very supportive of her and were very quick to dismiss any complaints from the school. And she actually told me that she came to feel that their support was really helpful. Others, single mothers, but who were white, told me stories where they felt, you know, unfairly judged by school personnel, and then their complaints were taken seriously by social workers and they were investigated. But eventually, charges against them for child neglect or endangerment were dismissed. But the one woman who actually had her child removed for a time, not surprisingly, was an African-American single mother, again, who was working, knew her daughter had issues. She was already had her seeing psychotherapists, already was looking for resources, but her daughter was also simply missing too many days of school. And then this was really held against her.
And I want to jump in there and just, you know, draw a connection that many of our listeners may be feeling right now to Baltimore and to a lot of the discussion that's happening sort of in the public discourse. We've heard particularly a lot of conservatives in sort of talk radio and on TV drawing really offensive connections between the unrest in Baltimore and what they're pointing to as sort of a quote epidemic of single mothers. Do you see a connection between that sort of mother blame in the public discourse in that context and the phenomenon you have observed with these 48 mothers?
Yes, I really see that very clearly. And I was just talking to a colleague about that, in fact. We were quite distressed that one clip of the African-American mother trying frantically to get her teenage son to come home with her away from the protest. And it's quite distressing that keeps being shown over and over and over again when she has, you know, every reason to be really frantic about her son, you know, and his future and his life. What I learned from the mothers I met with raising children of color is that they understand that their children's behavior is going to be framed very differently and that their mothering is going to be judged more harshly, but also that their children's behavior is going to be framed and judged more harshly due to really the persistence of very negative racist stereotypes in our society. And part of that certainly has to do with the idea that these homes are fatherless. I found that's also often a misnomer. Often, even if it's a single mother household, that doesn't mean the fathers of these kids aren't very present in their lives and involved in their lives. Just like in the movement Black Lives Matter, you know, there is the persisting stereotype that's very troubling of the dangerous Black young man. And that tends to affect boys in school at boys of color at surprisingly young ages. And so I met a mother who was very concerned that her son was being seen this way, and he was really only six. And she already said, I think, you know, he's tall for his age, he's unruly, you know, it's already that idea of the dangerousness. So I think it is very related to the protest movements that we're seeing now in Baltimore and around the country.
Our guest is Linda Blum, professor at Northeastern University and author of Raising Generation RX. Linda, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm joined in studio by Greg Kaufman, former reporter covering poverty for The Nation, and now our beloved editor of TalkPoverty.org and co-executive producer of the show. Welcome.
I'm so happy to be here with you.
You look happy.
I feel happy.
You're happy to finally have your name go from the, I guess, small computer screen and finally seeing your name in lights on Talk Poverty Radio.
Yes, I'm thrilled with that. And I'm just really excited with what you guys have already been doing with the show and glad to play any role on air to help out.
So briefly explain the relationship between TalkPoverty.org and Talk Poverty. Why do we have all these Talk Poverties going around?
That's a great question. So TalkPoverty.org every day features people who are living in poverty or at risk of poverty and people working on poverty, showing what the real authentic experiences are and the solutions that are available to dramatically reduce poverty. And so now we have this great radio show that's really doing a lot of the same things, but reaching people in different kinds of ways through our podcast, online, at WeACT Radio, and at TalkPoverty.org. So it's a really good fit and a good extension of our work.
Absolutely. And that's why we're going to have you come on from time to time to take some of the headlines off of TalkPoverty.org and interview some of the writers for the show.
Yeah. And today I'm going to get to talk to Levester, who has been on TalkPoverty.org and now is going to come into the studio and speak with us about some exciting things going on with him right now.
Perfect. Well, thank you for joining us, Greg.
Thanks, Tracy.
This is Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Greg Kaufman, editor of TalkPoverty.org. I'm joined now by a friend of the show, Levester Green, or Big City Joe to his fans from his radio days at WSSB at South Carolina State University. Levester is a filmmaker, a journalist, a published poet. He's also currently on the streets working as a vendor for Street Sense, DC's biweekly street newspaper. Levester, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with something very exciting that's happened to you since we last spoke. You co-directed with Brian Bellow a 30-minute documentary film entitled I Am Levester Joe Green, and it screened last month at the East Street Cinema here in Washington. And I'm, first of all, totally excited for you. And I just wanted to ask you how this project came about and how the screening went.
On the screening, we had a excellent turnout, you know, a full packed theater. They kept upsizing us, upgrading us to a bigger theater to accommodate all the requests.
That is really awesome. I'm really happy for both you and Brian. And I got to say, it's very poignant and it's a very powerful film. And as I watched it, it seemed to me, and you tell me if I'm right, like you were looking back at your life, really in order to better understand your present,
both as a man and as an artist. Is that what you were trying to do? And did the film help you to do that?
I think the film accomplished that. We initially set out trying to tell a story of, you know, my past accomplishments and my trials and tribulations, the ups and downs, and my path that led me to the doors of Street Sense and, you know, my new comrades in the journalistic world.
Yeah, and your poetry world, because there's a lot of poetry in the film.
Absolutely.
And one, somebody who plays a key role in the film, and here we are, we're talking a few days before Mother's Day, is your mom. There's a particularly a great scene where she recites this poem, just beautifully and dramatic. Was it her poem, first of all?
Well, that's her ode to Maya Angelou, one of her favorite poets. So we made sure to include that in, you know. She has a long list of reciting her poems when she used to work for the federal government in a group we call Federally Employed Women. So they used to have hold functions she won a couple of awards with them, like Women of Distinction. You know, she got that award a couple of times. So
yeah. In some ways, I felt like the film was really a look at your constant strive towards education. You say, and I quote you, that you went backwards from a 4-year college to a community college to a tech school. And in fact, at the end of the movie, you talk about making it into American University Library and the security guards at first giving you a little bit of a hard time. And then you guys were, as you said, you were cool.
Oh, yeah.
But has your life in a lot of ways been driven by your desire for education and for self-expression?
Oh, absolutely. On both of those points, you know, I'm a firm believer in Bill Clinton's philosophy of, you know, lifelong education. You constantly learn it throughout your lifetime. It's a ongoing process. And like I said, I consider myself a communicator, so I'm trying to express myself in each and every way, you know, from my hair to the clothes I wear, you know, every aspect of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are a couple tough moments in the film that made me actually think about what's happening in Baltimore right now, too. You talk about dealing with police brutality in your own life,
right?
Being falsely accused of stealing 50-cent donuts, even yeah. though you had plenty of cash to pay for them, and then having your arm broken.
Oh, yeah.
Has what's been happening in Baltimore right now connected with what you've experienced in your own life, and also the relationship between police brutality and poverty and homelessness?
Oh, most definitely. You know, I mean, I think it speaks to that quite poignantly, because you know, that's just one episode or plight I've had, you know, struggle I've had with the police and stuff, you know. And in one of my poems, I kind of speak to it. I say most of the things I've been through, most that y'all wouldn't survive it, you know. And it seems I heard that piece and I looked back at what's going on, especially the Freddie Gray incident in Baltimore. And it's another episode we recorded, but it wasn't included in the poem. I mean, in the film, and where I had another police brutality encounter. And, you know, they basically it felt like they were trying to break my back. And I ended up in, like, St. Elizabeth's for my troubles, you know. And that was also during my tenure at UDC. So, mm-hmm. you know, I definitely felt the impact of the Freddie Gray incident, you know, because that could have very easily been me and, you know, them trying to stuff me in the back of the van or something to transport me and me not being able to stand on my own. But, you know, fortunately, I've been built a little tougher and made for survival. So I'm still here. As one of the fortunate ones, because I'm still here and able to still express myself and tell my story and, you know, and rally with the rest of the survivors and you know, and protest against this brutality that's going over all over America.
Well, that actually reminds me of one of the poems you recited in the film, and I want to quote an excerpt. I'm sure you could read it better than I can, but I'll give it my best shot. It goes, my street people doing whatever they have to do to get through it, just happy to be alive and to have survived it. Mm-hmm. In the streets, you got to eat, so I be on the grind, the hustle, 7 days a week, trying to compete. The meek shall not get what they seek if they don't speak. Let's participate, don't just hate, street people, congregate.
Yeah, that was a beautiful rendition.
Well, thank you. I mean, for whatever reason, it moved me a lot. Yeah. And I wanted to take, you know, having this opportunity to interview you, I wanted to ask you what those words mean to you.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be looking for that YouTube edition of that. but yeah, they just speak to, like I said, from being on the street, I'm meeting new folks who have already been in a struggle or, you know, have already been dealing with homelessness for years now. And, you know, they kind of like showing me the ropes, you know, the ins and outs, how you really get by and survive, you know, because it is that serious. It is a game of survival, you know. You know, you already get harassed just for being around all the time. You know, you really have nowhere to go. So it could be a quite boring experience, a quite brutal experience. So it's a good stuff you would need to know just to get by and, you know, stay out of harm's way and continue living your life and trying to progress and get better.
And I'm pleased that we have your co-director of the film, Brian Bellow, in the studio with us. And Brian, I just wanted you to talk about a little bit, how did this collaboration happen? How did it come about?
Yeah, this is a story I've been saving for Brian to tell, so.
Well, thanks so much for having us on. Yeah, I just finished at American. The highlight of that experience has been sort of unlikely collaboration with my man Levester here. We just kind of randomly met one day, which maybe some people do all the time, but it's now lasted for 2 years, but I was just basically walking to the Metro one day, smoking a cigarette. I had a camera, and he asked if he could have one, and I was like, yeah, man, they're for giving away. And we started talking. I found out that he did poetry. I became really interested in the idea of, you know, filming poetry from a film I had seen that was filming dance and Wim Wenders' film. And so we, you know, we're like, okay, well, let's see how this works out. We started meeting up on the weekends, and from there we started collaborating and thinking about how we could turn this into something bigger. And we worked on a film that was a little more of my direction, which I'll show some stuff from in August. But then halfway through that, we realized, like, we got to get, you know, Levester's perspective, you know? And so you know, he's graceful and gave me the, you know, co-directing credit on helping him put this together, but totally arrived at a film that we wouldn't have arrived at if it was just me on the outside, you know, trying to think about, you know, what Levester's been through. I mean, he just owned this story just like he's owned his whole life in a way that is undeniably a testament to his spirit, and I was just grateful to be a part of it.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Levester and Brian, for coming on today. And I know we're going to keep talking, and we'll get you back here soon. And just, again, kudos for your great work, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us, man, and being a good supporter of Street Sense.
All right.
You know?
Absolutely. So take care, guys.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast, or you can listen online at weactradio.com. Special thanks to our executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and the one and only Greg Kaufman.
Special thanks also go out to our great intern, Will Strom.
CAP's amazing poverty and press teams.
And as always, DC's own Chris Stiles Bacon gets the last word. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money. money for the food and healthcare, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?
You are listening to the We Act Radio Network, produced in Washington, D.C. Visit us online at weactradio.com.